Teaching meditation can be a deeply rewarding experience. Help others improve their mental and emotional well-being, reduce stress, improve focus, increase self-awareness and self-regulation, all while deepening your own practice and understanding. Join acclaimed author, Buddhist teacher, and Emmy Award-winning musician David Nichtern on Tuesday, May 28th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time for a free online discussion on teaching meditation in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern on May 28th.
I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Server Member Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Server Member Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to Ram Dass Here and Now. I'm Raghu Marcus. And we're going to continue our explorations around Ram Dass's talk about sex and spirituality. There's some more great stuff in this talk around that, you know, everyday relationship that we have with sex and that particular energy and how it can be used as something that allows us to go beyond the polarization and duality that is so prevalent, especially in this culture, relative to coupling and to sex. And in this particular part of the talk, I was taken by some of the comments he made about the relationship to orgasm to transcendence, because certainly that's one of the most basic ways in which all of us experience a oneness at some point. I mean, you know, much of our relationship with sex, especially in the West, is very polarized and very objectified, and certainly is mostly not a way in which we transcend our egos. In fact, the other day I was talking to somebody about skepticism, actually, and we were talking about, well, when you have an experience with psychedelics, for instance, I mean, this was a powerful transformation tool for many of us, and still remains that for many of us, where we actually experience the interconnectivity of everything, the harmony of it all, and something beyond our normal perspective of senses, mind, ego. And we realize that there is another vantage point. There is a real way to experience reality beyond I, me, mine, should we say. And, you know, and when I started to talk about that, I started thinking about that. I was thinking at the, you know, at the same time, one of the first ways we experience that very same thing is the moment of orgasm. And we stop, especially obviously if there's love involved and it's not completely lust. So he talks here about the moment of orgasm. You transcend your separateness. That, you know, that moment when you merge, and gee, most all of us have had that moment, and that experience is kind of a building block to move in the direction where you realize that there is a place where we can become that which we experience through this orgasm. We can transcend. We can become one. We can see everybody from a different vantage point. For most people, as he says, it's the most direct route to a spiritually transcendent state. And people, it talks about people with powerful minds resist that moment of transcendence. So the moment of orgasm is very brief because people are afraid of losing control. What you learn to do in a lot of yoga forms is awakening the sexual energy, not to the point of orgasm, and here we're talking about Tantra, and drawing the energy up the spine into the higher chakras, energy points. And then we talk about Tantra, and here here's where it gets a little bit difficult. And Ram Dass talks about this later in the lecture. You create a partnership, and that partnership, it's created in order to keep awakening that energy. As you keep awakening that energy, you draw it up into the crown chakras. If there is an orgasm at that point, that orgasm is experienced over the head, not in the genitals. Now, that is the highest form of sexual Tantra. And that, as he says later in the talk, is a very, very difficult practice because, the predicament is with energy that's awakened in the first three chakras survival, sexual enjoyment, which, you know, allows the species, our species, to, you know, keep procreating. And then the third is power, is that in all of those chakras, you're automatically treating people as objects. And so it's very, very difficult to move out of that subject-object place. And that's why in this culture and in the West, I mean, this is something that's a pretty common belief in these times. It's pretty difficult. But I do think that it's something to shoot for, that we can all shoot for it in relation to our, you know, the kind of partnerships that we set up. Because when you do start to open through spiritual practices, through meeting a teacher, meeting your guru, meeting anybody who opens up our hearts in a way that, you feel the unity, and not just through an acid experience, not through just through orgasm, but through actual compassion and wisdom. And when you start to open, all chakras open. So compassion, so then you have a combination or a mixed bag of compassion, sexuality, desire, but then there's some balance, so you don't act in a way that creates suffering. I think this is very important, you know, for everybody, because the more polarization that we create in any parts of our lives, that creates suffering, then of course, you know, this is a continues the kind of karma that puts not just us but everybody around us in in a tight box and very hard to get out of it. Only when you're in balance with your upper chakras are you acting from the deeper harmony of life. So it's certainly very much something to aspire to. When to feed the second chakra, so from a spiritual point of view, this reiterates what we were just talking about, because it's using your energies in ways that diminish one's potential liberation. They keep entrapping you. The more you feed a desire, the more you strengthen that desire system. The art is to keep moving the energy into higher and higher realms of compassion, wisdom, merging, unity, and have them express less and less through subject-object. But you can't do it through repression. It just boomerangs back and catches you. So, he makes a big deal out of the fact that, by the end of the talk, that it's very, in his experience, and this is back then, I'm not quite sure, I think it was in the 90s this talk was given in England, but it's absolutely even more relevant probably today, that Tantra is very, very difficult. You have to have utterly complete, I would say, mastery over your mind and one-pointedness to be able not to get lost in lust, period. But I think these things are great to work towards, slowing down the process that you have with your partner so that you're not overwhelmed by lust, you're not caught in subject-object. And I love this part of the talk, which, in fact, I've experienced directly with Ram Dass, because about 4 years ago, Ram Dass married my lovely wife Saraswati and I in a beautiful ceremony. We were so fortunate that he agreed to do it. And the main part of it was his talk about creating a triangle. So that's the two partners, and the third part of the triangle is a shared awareness. And so you keep feeding everything. Of course you have to have an agreement that this is the main reason that you're together, is to feed these two points, you and your partner, into the third point, which represents the shared awareness. And that that shared awareness is playing with the energy that's created by the two polar points interacting, yin and yang. So then from that vantage point, I think it's really possible then to play with some of the energies of sacred sex, Tantra. Doing the abhyam, I'm sure everybody's looked at a tantric book at one point in their life, and sitting opposite each other and developing that one heart through eye contact and so on, until there's one awareness that moves into that transcendent moment of sexual union. So I think it's really, I think we can aspire to it. I don't think we have to get into a whole tantric practice as if that is our liberation possibility. I don't think so. But I think consciously using these practices is definitely a way, and definitely using this triangle idea, because it affects other parts of our partnership, our marriage, which whatever it may be. And so he calls that's the sacred part, that whole idea of coming together, two points coming with shared awareness and experiencing the sexual union. That's the sacred part. The profane part is every time you settle for personal gratification using your partner. Now, again, very difficult. I mean, you know, my own experience, it's been really in and out. I have aspired to this and not achieved it in many, many, you know, over my lifetime. I've been really fortunate in this partnership that I'm in now to have had, you know, that blessing of being really hearing what it is to have that shared awareness between us. So it's been pretty magical. Well, let's just hear the whole talk from Ram Dass. Thanks, everybody who's been listening, and thank you for supporting us. Please do continue to support us at ramdass.org. You can support through a donation. We even have an Amazon.com link. We have all sorts of different films and audios and meditations and chanting, all of which you can download and support us that way. So please continue. And here is the continuation of Ram Dass's talk on sex and spirituality and on Ram Dass here and now.
If you start from pran or just energy itself, then which way the energy gets directed is, we talked about the chakras or centers yesterday in the body. And as the energy gets directed in those ways, when it gets expressed through the second chakra, it's usually, it's experienced as sexual energy. and when it's directed through the third chakra, it's experienced as ego power and mastery and control. And it's actually the same energy, it's just directed through a different form, and as it comes through that form, it it colors reality and starts to affect the perception of what reality is about. Now, the fact that we are, the way the species reproduces itself and works is that after that, the energy first has to be in the first chakra because that has to do with survival and just continued existence. Once you are surviving and existing, then the next problem for the species is reproduction. So then that's why that's the second chakra, and that is where the energy is available next. When you're falling off a mountain, you're usually not very sexually aroused. and so it's only when your survival is assured that you start to experience the possibility of sexual arousal. The way the at the instinctual level, it is, of course, directed towards reproduction. But because the human mind is starts to create realities around the energy, it starts to build thought forms that awaken that energy, because the energy for us to reproduce, there is a lot of affective tone to that awakening of the energy, so there's a lot of pleasure. And in order to awaken that pleasure, we start to use our minds to increase it and to awaken that energy when the external stimulus that would awaken it isn't necessarily present. And as we get more and more evolved in playing with our minds, we end up really having sex in our minds more than actually the way in which it's originally designed, which is just for reproduction. Ramana Maharshi, who was a very great saint in India, looking at it from above, beyond, from spiritual point of view down, says, what is it when two bodies rub together? I mean, he really reduced it at that point to, you know, what big deal is it? And from his point of view, sex was only for reproduction. And all the rest of it was an aberrant behavior. We find that hard to handle because we built such incredible rituals around it. Because we, the intensity of that pleasure is so great, and that's, were it not that great, we wouldn't reproduce the species, actually. So it's quite functional. Now, what's interesting is the relation of orgasm to transcendence. Because at the moment of orgasm, you transcend your separateness. There's a moment when you merge. And that is, for most people, that is the most direct route to the spiritually transcendent state. And so that most people know through that experience what that's about. They know what it's talking about that moment of transcendence. And if you watch the way people who have very strong minds have sex, are involved in sexuality, you will see that they resist that transcendent moment. They love it, they're drawn towards, but they're frightened by it, and they regain the control as quickly as they can immediately afterwards, so that the moment of orgasm gets extremely brief for somebody that's got a powerful mind. For people who are not as attached to their separateness, the state of orgasm gets longer and longer and longer, which is the state in which one is not separate. But for most people that have strong third chakra power needs and mastery and control needs, the loss of control in orgasm is both frightening and exhilarating for them. So it's interesting that transcendence and reproduction should be as intimately linked. I mean, I think that's an exquisite design by whoever figured that one out, because that's such a powerful mix. But it is exactly the same energy. It's just in a, it's just moving in a different place. And what you learn to do in a lot of yogic forms, awakening the sexual energy, not to the point of orgasm, just awakening that energy, and then drawing the energy up the spine into the upper chakras. And in Tantra, which is that concerned with that technique, you use a partnership in order to keep awakening that energy. And as you keep awakening that energy, you draw it up and up into the up into here and here and here and here. Keep moving the energy up. And actually, if there is an orgasm at that point, the orgasm is experienced over the head rather than in the genitals. It's just moving the energy. It's awakening the energy and then moving it, awakening it, moving it, awakening it, moving it. The predicament with energy that is awakened in the first three chakras is that it treats other people as objects. In survival, it's me versus you. In reproduction, in second chakra, it is a desire that's awakened for pleasure, for gratification, which uses you to give me that gratification. That's what the issue of lust is. Lust is taking an object. It's seeing another being as an object for your gratification. In third chakra, it's power relationships or control or mastery over another person. It's only when you get up into the fourth chakra that there is a quality of us rather than me versus you, or me as opposed to you, or you as object, in which the us is starts to be us as subject. And so the question then is, if you are in your fourth chakra, would you have sex if the energy is up here? Can you have sex with somebody that isn't an object? Can you have sex without lust? And I think most of you know that that is obviously possible. And then it is, the sex comes out of a karmic appropriateness rather than, it's not that every, I mean, as you open up more and more and you start to be in love with more and more people, more and more of them can be sexual partners potentially. I mean, there's the openness, the flow of energy is going back and forth. And then who it is you actually would have sex with would be a function of the appropriateness of the karma. And some people you say hello to, some you shake hands with, some you go to bed with, and some you'll produce children with. And you are quiet enough to listen to that and find the appropriateness of it. And I notice that often, I notice that as my heart is open more and more, I love people more and more. And when you love somebody very intensely and you feel that love flowing back and forth, many people interpret that in second chakra because that's where they're hearing it from. And they get to desire relationship, desire intimacy. And often I experience with somebody that it has, that every relationship for me starts to have a sexual tone to it. It all, because when you're finally, as you open more and more, all your chakras are open. It's not like you close the lower ones and open the upper ones. It ends up that they're all open all at once. So that it's compassion and desire and sexuality, but it's all in balance so that you then only act in a way that doesn't create suffering. And you begin to see that when you act out of first, second, and third chakra, ultimately you are creating suffering when you act out of them exclusively. It's only when they are in balance with the upper chakras so that the actions are in the deeper harmony of things. And often I'll say to somebody, wouldn't it be nice for us to sleep together, but we can't afford it because we'll just create too much suffering with it because we will interpret it at the wrong level. We're just not, it's not appropriate for this situation. That's the beginning for that question. Yes. Next. I'm going to do them all with dispatch today.
Right. Well, you've already answered this one, really. I think it's about the Buddha saying you have right sexual conduct, which I think you, unless you'd like to elaborate on that, what is right sexual conduct? And how often can we have it?
And how what?
How often can we have it?
What is right sexual conduct and how often can we have it? The Buddha said twice a week. and never on Sunday. Well, generally, we come back to the issue of what kind of karma you create. And when you look at the statement, and this is a delicate one for people, some people in this room even, thou shalt not commit adultery. What is the relation between that and, say, open marriages? I think what the way I hear it is, you don't get so caught in your desire systems that you perform acts which create suffering in other people. And when you have a contract with another person, and then you act with a third person without the release from that contract or without the knowledge, in other words, you react behind another person's back to perform a sexual behavior, you increase the paranoia in the world and you increase, there's a karmic cost in that. You don't get away free from it. And when it is designed to allow people to feel safe enough in relationship, trust through contract, to be able to open and to be able to be vulnerable, if you will. And when you misuse that contract, you are creating a world in which you can't trust. And when you create that world, you then have to live in it. So there is clearly a karmic effect from misuse of human contracts in that way. So I think the sexual misconduct is primarily, in Buddhism, it refers to incest, it refers to somebody else's partner, it refers to just behaviors that create suffering because they rip the fabric of the structure that you need for a social structure to exist. That's roughly what we're talking about. In terms of incest, there's probably some genetic reasons for it, but I mean, in terms of adultery there obviously isn't. Beyond that, I think that most spiritual people now have relaxed a lot about what are the no-nos in sexuality. I think that everybody isn't drummed out of the core because of masturbation, homosexuality, things like that. I think that's all been nobody's. The idea is that to feed the second chakra from a spiritual point of view is really it's really using your energies in less than the way that they could liberate. They keep entrapping you in that. The more you feed a desire, the more you strengthen that desire system. And I noticed that when I got into, when I went to India or going to a Buddhist monastery, that the amount of sexual fantasy and sexual energy almost disappears entirely in my life. And I think, well, isn't that interesting? Where did that go? It's not like I repress it. It's merely that the vibratory energy of the space I'm in and the collective consciousness of the group I'm around just doesn't awaken that energy at all. And it's quite a relief, actually. It's like it frees you for a lot of other things. Because for many people, their sexual preoccupations are very intense. They're spending a great deal of time thinking about who to partner with and who they're attracted to, and there are an incredible number. And it was interesting to me that in the United States, we have meditation centers. And in the meditation centers, the staff are back in the kitchen coupling and doing whatever they do, while all the meditators are sworn to celibacy. In Burma and places, all the staff are very, very committed to the spiritual practice. When I was in the Western monasteries, I continued to feel those sexual vibrations in the environment. When I was in Burma, I didn't. And often in places in India. And it's interesting because even in India they have such a high birth rate, and in the East they have such a high birth rate, so they must be doing something somewhere. But it's interesting that there isn't the lust issue. There is reproduction, but there isn't that much preoccupation of the mind with these issues. And that has to do with the vibratory rate of the energies that you're around all the time. And so there is much to be said for allowing yourself the opportunity to come into environments where that isn't such a major preoccupation. And you begin to feel, I'm beginning to feel with age, of course, like new vistas are opening up to me because I don't have to spend all my time so obsessed with sexuality. So, see, the art is to keep moving the energy into the higher and higher realms of compassion, of wisdom, of merging, of unity, and have them express less and less through subject-object. But you can't, if you try to do it by repressing it, to force it up, it comes back, it boomerangs, it comes back and catches you. And you don't want to get caught in what I call the horny celibate syndrome, which is the busy not having sex that I talked about the other day. So what you are looking for is the way in which your mind, you focus your mind on these other realms, these spiritual realms, which then just allow you to re-perceive the universe. Like, for example, if I'm in a room, I can look around and I will find somebody that will arouse my prurient interest, that will arouse my sexual awakening. But if I will just stay looking at that person and just quiet down for a moment, I will begin to see through that particular veil of object, and I will see another soul in there who is packaged in the way, and that package is like with a geese or a ducks. With baby ducks, if you just show a silhouette of a mother duck, the baby duck will open its mouth for feeding. And it's built in. It's an instinctual response, just a silhouette of it on a piece of cardboard, and the baby like this. And if you put a silhouette of a pig, it won't do that. It just, and so it's all built into the organism. And in the same way for all of us, it's built in too. We go, you know, or we get aroused when a certain pattern goes by. And so then you look at the soul that happens to be incarnated in that pattern. And you realize what a hell realm it must be to be somebody, for example, that in cultural terms is very beautiful. See, they have incredible power on the third chakra and second chakra realms, but nobody can get through that to see them behind it. And you find people that have tremendous symbolic power, either political power or sexual power, starving to death as souls. Can you hear the issue? Because nobody can meet them, because everybody gets caught in the veil. And the art is to look, and when a veil catches you, like somebody with vast power or vast attractiveness, physical attractiveness, and you start to respond, to stay quiet long enough to allow yourself to get through that one, to meet the being behind it. And the minute you do that, the whole game changes. The whole meaning of it changes. The compassion is reawakened. And then out of that compassion, you will do with that person what is compassionate, what is going to liberate both of you. And it could be sex and it could not be sex. It wouldn't matter at that point. You'd listen to hear what would be appropriate. So is that dealing with the question? Yes.
Ramdas, how can we make sex sacred?
Doing it in church? I gotta watch this. I'm getting out of control here. Things that come to mind in response to that question are the way in which you make something into a sacrament, the way in which you invest a ritual, the way in which you slow down the process so that lust is not, lust meaning the seeing another being as an object. Because anytime you do anything which separates beings, you have profaned the universe. You have, anytime you fail to see the unity that lies behind the diversity, you've just closed your awareness to God. And you've separated people and isolated them. And a lot of people who have sex end up feeling separate from their partners through the sexuality, because they got involved in their own greed for a certain experience. And they didn't slow down enough to be with their partner, so that the sexual process increased the shared awareness of it. In a relationship, and this really is, I guess we'll deal with this more in relationship stuff, so I won't get too much into it, but it's as if in any relationship between two people, there's three points of the triangle. There's the two partners, and then there's the shared awareness, which is the third thing. And you keep feeding into that third thing until it is really awareness, it's shared awareness that is playing with the energy that's created by these two polar points interacting, the yin and yang, or the yab and yum, or the whichever way you want to call that. These two different energies working. And it's as if one awareness is working with these two energies. And the minute you get identified with one of the energies or the other, you polarize the situation, and you create opposite, and you create other. And then you have profaned the way in which it is the one delighting in itself. So for that process to happen, you have to slow down enough so that you take the initial desire system and use, slow down, like in tantric practices, where you sit opposite your partner and you have enough control and discipline to take each new level of arousal and move it into the shared awareness that exists between the two of you, so that all of the energy is constantly feeding up the spine to bringing the two of you more into your heart and more into your wisdom and more into that shared awareness. And the energy keeps feeding in and feeding in and feeding in until finally it is one awareness experiencing the transcendent moment of sexual union. And that's the sacred part of it. And the profanity is every time you settle for personal gratification using your partner. Is that dealing with the issue? Interesting one. But you see, you can see how powerful those systems take and how common the culture is about seeing other beings as objects. I mean, that's what all of second chakra stuff is about, is all of pornography, all of it is object sex, which is terribly isolating to human beings and really demeaning to the human condition. I mean, it really makes it less. It makes it less. It profanes it. It cuts us off from God. And certainly something as exquisitely beautiful as sex shouldn't cut us off from God. Yeah. Questions?
In a situation where there is quite strong sexual desire, there's enough heart openness to know that you don't feel it's appropriate to act on it. There's enough wisdom to know that you don't want to repress it, but there's not yet enough witness to be able to just sit back and say, ah, so, what do you do with it?
Burn, baby, burn. This is not just a question about sexuality, it's a question about all desire systems, really. That there is a period where you're in between, where you know enough to know that if you gratify the desire, you're creating more suffering, more karma, and yet you're not witness or not conscious enough to be able to let it go. And there's a long period for most of us where we just sit in that. It's like a hell realm, or it's an in-between space. And you just sit there. You sit with it. And you sit with it often shared with another person, that you can't go forward and you can't go backwards. And you just sit with it. And in time, it transforms itself. It turns into something else. It's bittersweet. There's a grief reaction because you can't have what you want, because you know too much. See, there's a lot, there's an interesting stage in spiritual awakening where you wish you could go back to sleep again. Because you know too much to do the things that you wanted to do, but you don't know enough to not want them. And you're just caught in between those places. And that's a period. It's a long period. And you just sit with it. There's nothing to do about it, really. There's nothing to do about it. And the what's important is that you stay as close to the truth with your the other partner as you can, because the minute you get into denial, then you're locking it in for longer. But if you both agree that in this situation there's nothing we can do about it, because we both see that it's not a compassionate act, and yet we both have the desire, we can sit with it, and in a way we create a bond of awareness that is behind the desire systems. And that bond of awareness can get stronger enough and strong enough until the two of us are sharing that awareness. And that, it's interesting that ultimately you experience a quality so intimate that for us to have physical experience, we would have to come down into separateness in order to do that, to awaken that desire. And that's what I think that Ramana Maharshi was talking about when he was saying, what is it if two bodies rub together? Because at a certain point, you are so, when your awareness is not identified with your time, space, locus anymore, you keep merging into the people around you. And it's that in-being in the dog story, the thing of Rilke. You become merged with that other being so much, you're already sharing the same space of awareness. It's as if the cells have already merged together. There's only one of us. And then to come back down into I desire you seems less. Do you hear that? And so when you are in a desire system that you're stuck in, as you cultivate that shared awareness more and more through truth, then the two of you can start to feel the intimacy. It's as if you get the predicament is that with sex is a good example, you get hooked on your method rather than on the object of the method, the goal of the method. The goal of the method is the shared intimacy, where you feel complete, where you feel fulfilled, where you feel at peace. But one gets hooked on their method of getting there, so that meditators end up being meditators, and lusters end up being lusters, instead of being realizing that what they want is that feeling of peace, or at oneness, or at homeness. And that can, when you can't find it through that route because it's not compassionate, then you move beyond it and you come into that, you come to the goal without using the method and get free of being hooked to the method. Because we do get addicted to our methods. Those people that use psychedelics get hooked to psychedelics. The people that use meditation get hooked to meditation. The people that use sex get hooked to sex. And actually, they're all going to the same place. Yes.
I hear what you're saying. You also said earlier that there is a place where you're in that shared awareness, but can enjoy the play of being two people involved in a sexual relationship. How does that relate to what you were just saying about coming back down into division?
Well, once you and I share the awareness together, then we hear the Tao, we hear the way of things in the universe. And in that way of things, you and I will hear the way in which we can dance together. The dance together may be we'll be colleagues in a business venture. It may be we'll be lovers. It may be we'll be friends. It may be we will be associates in some way or other. It may be we are mother and child, or father and son, or some father and daughter. We just keep hearing what is appropriate that doesn't create waves, that doesn't create suffering in the system. And then you come down and play as two. It becomes, then it's when it comes back into the game or the dance or the play. When you're already in love, and it can happen, it's very far out how it can happen. I've talked about this, I think, last year, but in my role in the SEVA Foundation, at one point as a chairman of the board, which I was, we have a rotating chairmanship, I found myself representing SEVA in Nepal, where we do a lot of blindness surgery and we build clinics and we're building a hospital now and train people and so on. And I found myself meeting with the Minister of Health, as I was the chairman of the board of a foundation from America, and he represents the King of Nepal. And we came together and I wore my tie and my blue blazer and I was Dr. Das we met and we had tea and I had my entourage and he had his entourage and I needed him to relax some of the bureaucracy of the structure so that we could train a category of people called ophthalmic assistants that would help the surgeons to relieve the caseload, and he had to give up certain rules that the government had, which was trying to make it legitimized in the international medical community. I mean, there was a little political structure going on here, and what he wanted from me, of course, was more money, and because it's an American foundation. And we all understood, and we came together each with our wish list. And I was a little nervous because I was having to be straight, which I hadn't been for years. I mean, I was having to be representing the team back home, and I couldn't give away the store, and I was a little nervous that I could play tight enough in this situation, and I was, you know, doing my beads nervously and trying to remember Ram. And we were about to start the bargaining, and I was caught in being the chairman of the board, I mean, in playing my role properly. I was caught in my role. I wasn't playing it. I was caught in it. And at that moment, I happened to look into his eyes, which you'd, because when you're caught in a role, you don't look into people's eyes because you're busy being somebody. And I just happened to look into his eyes, and there he was sitting there looking at me. And our eyes held for a moment, and that was just long enough for me to realize that he was right here. He wasn't caught. I mean, he was an Easterner. He knew much more than I did. And he freed me at that moment. And we met, we suddenly just fell into each other's eyes. Just that moment, we fell into love, really. And then we recognized the oneness of, it's like two souls. Well, what'll we do today? Well, I'll tell you what, I'll be the Minister of Health, okay. Well, I'll be the Chairman of the Board. And suddenly, we were just playing these games out. And then we fought fiercely. It was like Monopoly. And I'll trade you Park Avenue for the B&O Railroad. And we got into this bargaining, but the more we bargained, it was like making love, the more intimate we got. And the oneness allowed us to play our game, not sloppily, but very well. But we didn't get caught in the game, so we weren't opponents. We were collaborating in our competition, okay? And so the competition kept bringing us closer and closer together. That's the way in which it worked. Questions? Yes. He's asking, in those systems where they work with sexual energies in terms of lust and all, to arouse that stuff, to examine it and work with it, I think that it takes somebody who is extremely conscious and extremely clear themselves about it to play with those energies without getting lost in it. And I think most people that say they're doing Tantra are grossly rationalizing in a way to justify their lust. I think that there's a tremendous amount of fraudulence in that game. I think there are very few people that are able to do sexual Tantra because it takes absolute one-pointedness of mind and where you start from up here and then you delve down here. You don't start from here. You hear that? So that I would say that about, in my experience, about 80% of what I hear of people talking about Tantra and working with sexual energies is gross rationalization, and that a very few people I've ever met are able to do that thing successfully.
This podcast is brought to you by the Love Serve Remember Foundation and Ramdas.org. We appreciate you listening, and we appreciate all the support that you've given us. Please continue that support and donate at Ramdas.org. We can then continue to share what Ram Dass has been sharing for all of these years. Thank you.